paraphrase the poignant poem found in the Gnezah, the people of Israel returned to its house of prayer. And understanding what occurred when the Byzantine ban on Jewish prayer ended, we can therefore appreciate the terrible irony of a decision many, many years later by Dayan to refuse true Jewish access to the locus of Jewish devotion. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 123, A Return to the Mount. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was a statement uttered by Moshe Dayan in the midst of wondrous events, a statement that reflected an attitude that was linked to a tragic mistake in Israel's history. An article in the newspaper Israel Hayom provides the context. Quote, "It was the second day of the 1967 Six-Day War. For the first time in 19 years, an Israeli convoy reached Mount Scopus unaccompanied by Jordanian legionnaires. Standing on the roof of the National Library, looking out over the Temple Mount and its shining domes, then Defense Minister Moshe Dayan rested his hand on the shoulder of GOC Central Command Colonel Uzi Narkis, sighed deeply, and whispered a key sentence that would later shed light on the manner of conduct surrounding the Temple Mount. What do we need this Vatican for?" End quote. This was the view of Moshe Dayan, who immediately after the Old City's liberation oversaw the handing of the keys of the Temple Mount back to the Waqf and the consigning of Jews from then on to the status of second-class citizens on the sacred site. It is a statement that ought to be remembered with pain, a reference to the locus of Jewish devotion for thousands of years as, quote-unquote, this Vatican. And it takes on a more painful irony when we understand the hopes and dreams and actions of the Jews in Jerusalem in the 7th century, when the persecution of the Byzantine Empire was suddenly lifted, and Jews for a brief moment believed that they could pray again on the Mount, and indeed, evidence indicates that they did. As we discussed yesterday, the rise of the Umayyad rulership in the 7th century CE set the stage for a brief moment of religious toleration, and this allowed for a genuine Jewish return to the sacred city. We have mentioned in the past episodes how under the Byzantines, Jews were largely barred not only from true access to the Mount, but from a genuine presence in the larger region of Jerusalem, retaining their presence in the north, in the Galilee, allowed to mourn at the Mount only on the 9th of Av, when, as Jerome recounted, Jews needed to bribe the guards atop the Mount to stay just a bit more to mourn and remember. Aside from the exceptions that have provided episodes on this podcast, this was a reality that existed to a great extent for the many centuries since the age of Hadrian. But suddenly, with the overthrow of Byzantine rule and the rise of the Umayyads, Jews returned to Jerusalem and began setting up infrastructures of Jewish life. The scholar F.E. Peters, in his remarkable book published in the 1980s, Collecting Sources from Diverse Faiths about the Experience of Jerusalem, tells us as follows, quote, "The first Jews to take up formal residence there were the rabbis of Tiberias, the spiritual and intellectual descendants of the Yochanan ben Zakkai, whom we saw escape from Jerusalem in AD 70 to found an academy at Yavne. Out of that school, which eventually found a more or less permanent home in Tiberias and Galilee, came the literary and legal foundations of rabbinic Judaism, namely the oral law redacted about AD 200 into the Mishnah, and the commentaries of succeeding generations of rabbis that constitute the Jerusalem Talmud. As far as authorship is concerned, the latter name is singularly inappropriate since none of these scholars who contributed to it could live, study, or teach in Jerusalem. In 638, that situation changed, and shortly after the Muslim conquest, the yeshiva, as it was subsequently called, moved from Tiberias to its natural home in Jerusalem. Though in modern usage the word yeshiva most generally means school, the newly constituted Jerusalem yeshiva was hardly that. It was rather, as Goitian has defined it, a council of learned men who discussed and decided questions of religious belief, law, and ritual addressed to them, or questions which arose during their own study of the sacred texts. The yeshiva was then part curia, part tribunal, school, and legislative body, and its head, the Gaon, had acknowledged jurisdiction over all the Jews of the Western diaspora, while his counterparts in Iraq were the chief legal authority for the Jews of the Muslim East. Thanks to the documents uncovered in that rich storehouse of medieval Jewish life called the Cairo Gnezah, we have a detailed picture of the structure of both the Palestinian yeshiva and the community that it served. The Gaon, together with the president of the court and a board of 5 international notables, constituted the council of the yeshiva. Though its judicial sessions often took place in the Muslims' political capital of Ramya, the yeshiva itself was located in Jerusalem, and its administrative and educational activities took place there. the fixing of the annual calendar, the liturgy in the community synagogue, study of the law in the house of study, and a good deal else in the house of the Gaon or the president of the court, end quote. The arrival of this academy of institutionalized law and learning, often unremarked today, actually marks an important moment in Jewish history. It reflects the first return of institutionalized Jewish learning to Jerusalem since the destruction of the temple, since Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai fleeing the city. This, then, is what occurred in Jerusalem in the 630s CE. But what of the Temple Mount itself and the Jewish relationship with it? There is evidence that when the original battle between the forces of Omar and those of the Byzantines was launched, some Jews thought that this clash might mark the onset of the apocalyptic war of Gog and Magog described in Ezekiel, one that is described as preceding the Messianic Age. F.E. Peters, in the aforementioned book, notes a remarkable poem from this era, also found in the Cairo Gniza. Part of this poem reads, quote, "On that day when the Messiah, son of David, will come to a downtrodden people, these signs will be seen in the world and will be brought forth. Earth and heaven will wither, and the sun and the moon will be blemished, and the dwellers in the land of Israel will be struck silent. The king of the west and the king of the east will be ground one against the other, and the armies of the king of the west will hold firm in the land. And a king will go forth from the land of Yoktan," which means Arabia, "and his armies will seize the land." The poem goes on and ends with a description of the Jewish aspiration. "And Israel will be freed of all their sins and will no more be kept far from the house of prayer," end quote. No longer kept from the house of prayer. This is a reference to Isaiah's description of the end of days when the Temple Mount will be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Of course, this war proved not to be the end of days, merely a change in rulership, but one with real significance for the Jewish population in the land of Israel. Soon a space for Muslim prayer was created atop the mount that would ultimately become the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And we must understand the precise location of where this mosque was created because so many misunderstandings persist about the Temple Mount to this day. The house of worship that became the Al-Aqsa Mosque was built on the southern end of the Temple Mount, what had originally been the extension created by Herod, beyond the original square Temple Mount of Ezra and Nehemiah, the square Temple Mount of Solomon. And what that means is that that section, the Herodian extension of the Mount, would not have been the central site atop the Temple Mount where Jews would have sought first and foremost to pray. Rather, they would have wanted to pray elsewhere on the Mount, in the area that marked the original Solomonic Temple Mount. And it seems that they did pray there. F.E. Peters gives us an account from the 10th century Jerusalem Karaite, Salman ben Yerucham, who, describing events 300 years before, writes the following, and I bring Peter's citation of Salmon. This 10th century Karaite wrote, quote, "As it is known, Jerusalem remained under the rule of the Rum, the Byzantines, for more than 500 years, during which they, the Jews, were not able to enter Jerusalem. Anyone who was discovered entering was killed. When, by the mercy of the God of Israel, the Rum departed from us, and the kingdom of Ishmael, the Arabs, appeared, the Jews were granted permission to enter and reside there. The courts of the house of the Lord were handed over to them, where they prayed for a number of years," end quote. Thus we have this account from several centuries later about Jewish prayer on the Mount in the 7th century. And even more fascinatingly, as Bar-Ilan's Meir Loewenberg cites in an article in Chakira Journal, we have an essentially contemporary account during the 7th century from Bishop Sibius, an Armenian cleric and historian who wrote the following, quote, "After the Jews enjoyed the aid and protection of the Arabs for a long time, they conceived the idea of rebuilding the Temple of Solomon. They identified the location of what they called the Holy of Holies, and there they built a prayer hall, using the foundations and the remnants of the original building. Once they had started to build, the Arabs became jealous and banished them from there. Instead, they gave the Jews another area on the Temple Mount for a synagogue," end quote. As Loewenberg adds, quote, "There is overwhelming evidence that there was an active synagogue on the Temple Mount during the early Muslim period," end quote. Or, to paraphrase the poignant poem found in the Gniza, "The people of Israel returned to its house of prayer." And understanding what occurred when the Byzantine ban on Jewish prayer ended, we can therefore appreciate the terrible irony of a decision many, many years later by Dayan to refuse true Jewish access to the locus of Jewish devotion, reflecting the attitude that he expressed with the statement, "What do I need this Vatican for?" And thereby ensuring the exact opposite of the hope expressed in the 7th century in the remnant of the poem found in the Cairo Gniza, ensuring, sadly, that the people of Israel were prevented from returning to pray at its house of prayer, indeed ensuring that the Jews were the people in the faith that could not pray at its most sacred site. Of course, While it seems that there was indeed a Jewish return to the Temple Mount in the 7th century, it is not clear that this lasted long, and according to Peters, it was with the creation of the larger complex by the Umayyads on the Temple Mount, including most famously the Dome of the Rock, that Jewish access ultimately became more limited. But that part of the story also has fascinating newly discovered aspects, which testify to the fact that the Jewish connection to and history on the Mount was once acknowledged in some fashion by those ruling in the Holy Land during that period. This is an aspect of Jerusalem's history that has long been forgotten, but one which archaeologists and scholars are now beginning to uncover. And it is this story that we will tell next week as our tale continues. This is Meir Soloveitchik, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, looking forward to learning together next week, signing off.